Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is one of the nation's top experts on the best practices to end homelessness in American communities and one of the featured guests at the Zero Mental Health Symposium going on this week in Tulsa. Jeffrey Olivet is the CEO of the Center for Social Innovation in Needham, Massachusetts. The center specializes in translating the latest research on human services problems, like homelessness, into real-world tools, training, and technical assistance. Olivet has been working on issues like homelessness, poverty, and HIV services with the organization since 1993. And in his human services career, he's worked as an outreach worker, care manager, housing director, trainer, and now CEO. Today, he works on big-picture human services delivery systems with organizations across the United States and in South Africa, Kenya, and Nigeria. Again, he's a guest at the Zero Mental Health Symposium today, which continues through Friday. And I spoke with him earlier this week by phone. Jeffrey Olivet, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Rich.
You'll be talking about the historical roots of homelessness when you're a plenary speaker at the Zero Mental Health Symposium. And when I think about the historical roots, I think of our country as being noted for its mobility. You know, we're far more likely to move around than most other countries in the world. Has homelessness been a part of the American psyche for a long time, or is it more of a recent development?
I would say it's been part of the American landscape since the beginnings of this country, but not part of the American psyche at all points in our history. We're in a kind of contemporary spike in homelessness that has brought the issue to a more visible level, and I think more present, particularly in the urban landscape around the United States.
Now, when we think of the major spikes, I think of certainly after the Vietnam War, when we really had a lack of serious veteran services from people suffering from trauma, the closing of a lot of governmental mental health institutions. Has this added to that sort of sense? I mean, it's really put homelessness on the consciousness from those acts and the fact that we had spikes after those events.
Absolutely. I think there's a direct connection between the public policy choices that we make as a society, both in terms of federal, state, and local budgets, in terms of where philanthropy and the faith community put their attention, that can either help fix the problem of homelessness or make it worse. And I think if you look at the convergence of events in the late 70s and early 80s, you hit on two of the big ones: deinstitutionalization of people who are living in mental institutions, who are locked up in many cases for decades, and this includes family members of mine, the ending of the Vietnam War, and many people returning with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, with drug and alcohol issues, and really having trouble integrating. The third major driver of the contemporary wave of homelessness that started in the late 70s and early 80s were dramatic cuts in affordable housing across the country. Our federal government de-invested in public housing and other strategies to provide safe, decent, and affordable housing for people throughout the 70s and 80s, and you can track the rise in homelessness right up against that public policy choice.
Most people would not think of the affordable housing as perhaps a big issue in homelessness, but how important was that to this rise that we saw in the late 70s, early 80s, and really, you know, through the 90s, really?
I think it's the single most important driver of it, of the current spike in homelessness. I think the question of homelessness is a question of access to housing. It's not only that, but homelessness by definition means not having access to housing that you can afford. I think the perception is often made that people are homeless either by choice or because of some other personal vulnerability, personal failing, whether that's addiction or domestic violence or unemployment or whatever. But the reality is things like mental illness and addiction don't cause homelessness. What causes homelessness is lack of affordable housing and lack of access to services and supports. What drives vulnerability for homelessness are some of those other sort of individual factors, like mental illness, like addiction, like lack of job skills or education. But the causes of homelessness, the root causes, are now and have always been related to societal, political, and economic structures that keep poor people poor.
Of course, the government has a really checkered record when it comes to providing affordable housing or even housing for folks in poverty. In fact, a lot of our efforts, I think, when we look at past efforts, were pretty misguided with the, you know, the high rises that, you know, we tore down within 20 years. But we didn't replace it with a better model, did we?
I'll pause there for a second on that. I think we've seen on a small scale some very effective practices. There are some exciting trends in the homelessness and affordable housing field around something called Housing First that
right.
really focuses on providing safe, decent, and affordable housing for people regardless of where they are in their mental health treatment, regardless of where they are with sobriety from drugs or alcohol. And essentially how it works is that you'd subsidize housing for people even while they're at their most vulnerable so that they can get on their feet, so that they can get on a path to recovery, so that they can re-engage with family and friends and church and formal treatment as well.
And, of course,
that's been an incredibly exciting trend. I just don't know that we've scaled it up to a degree where it has fully solved the problem.
And of course, Tulsa is very much involved in that Housing First initiative and making great progress. Now, we don't have, I don't think we've really had huge numbers of chronically homeless in our community compared to maybe other cities, but we're making great progress here in our community using that Housing First model. But I'm thinking about really big cities where, you know, you had these housing complexes that, well, they became ghettos in many ways. That was the government approach, be it local or national, and that didn't work, but we didn't find these other models where, you know, smaller size units could be scaled up in the way you're talking about.
Again, I think we've found the models, but we haven't scaled them up. I think if you look in communities across the country, both large, small, as well as rural communities, there are some very effective small-scale supportive housing programs that focus on either chronic homelessness, which you mentioned earlier, or increasingly with veterans. We're seeing a wonderful approach to housing homeless veterans over the last couple of years to really prevent what you identified correctly earlier after Vietnam, where we really let people slip through the cracks. So I think, again, we're doing it, but on a small scale. And I think if you look at some of these supportive housing models, where it's not just putting a roof over people's heads, but it's also focused on skill building and reconnection to community and really getting at the underlying problems that may contribute to someone's homelessness, we just simply haven't replaced the units on a large enough scale. So what we're doing is working, but there aren't enough resources going into it. There's not enough public awareness of these effective practices, and I'm not sure public policy at the federal, state, or local level has fully thrown its weight behind some of the really effective solutions that have been piloted.
So what will it take to mobilize that support?
I think it takes leadership at all levels, and I don't mean just by our elected officials. I mean by strong voices in the community, including voices from the nonprofit sector, voices from the private sector, from the business community, voices from the faith community, and voices of people who have been there themselves. I think it's vital that in Tulsa and everywhere else across the country that people who have been homeless are part of the solution and have a seat at the table and a voice in the media and a voice in public policy, because they understand. They know what has worked. They know what hasn't worked. They know where the system is broken. So I think it takes vocal and coordinated leadership. I also think it takes resources. I don't think this is magic. I think you invest money in things, and whether that's done through public-private partnership, through the philanthropic community, through the faith community, my feeling personally is that it needs to be all of the above, that there's not one sector, public, private, or otherwise, that can solve these very complex, very deep-rooted problems. As I said at the beginning of our conversation, Rich, the issue of homelessness has been with us since the beginning of this country, and you can see historical spikes during the Great Depression, after the Civil War, even during colonial days, and you can also track the successful responses during those spikes and to look at how both funding and public awareness and public insight has been able to focus on solutions and really help end homelessness one person at a time.
One of the things, you know, when people think of the perception of who is homeless, they do tend to think of mental disorders, substance abuse, perhaps even to a lesser extent, trauma. You mentioned the lack of affordable housing. What about economic dislocation and the whole idea of, you know, the spike in the Great Depression when people lost jobs, they lost houses, they lost families. We have good models, and I would think we have good models in place today for simple economic dislocation, or do we?
I think it's difficult. Certainly when there is economic recession or economic depression, we see spikes in homelessness. And I think we've certainly seen a spike in the last 2 years, particularly with homeless families. As I said a few minutes ago, we've done very good work as a society, as a country, to begin addressing veteran homelessness, to begin addressing so-called chronic homelessness, people who have been living on the streets or in shelters for a long time. But what we've not done a good job of, I think, ever in our history is prevention, is keeping people from slipping through the cracks to begin with. And so the response becomes a Band-Aid one and an emergency response that often involves shelter, food and clothing, just basic kind of basic necessities, which are absolutely vital when someone's living on the street. But the more important question is, how do we prevent that in the first place? How do we identify families who are at risk, individuals who are at risk, and intervene before they slip through the cracks into homelessness? And I think if you look at people whose jobs have gone away in the last couple of years during this current recession, whose homes have been lost to foreclosure, we didn't do a good job creating a safety net for them. We didn't do a good job identifying them beforehand and saying, you know, how do we prevent homelessness in the first place? It is absolutely clear that once people are homeless, it is more expensive, it is more costly, both in terms of, you know, human life and suffering, but also in terms of economics. Homelessness is more expensive than housing and support.
And this is one of the best arguments I've heard about getting governments, either local, state, or federal, to spend more money, is the fact that you are spending more money when people are on the streets than if they have some sort of shelter, even if it's a freely given shelter.
That's right. I think there are some very good cost studies that have emerged from communities around the country that show pretty definitively that it costs somewhere in the neighborhood of $40,000 a year to keep someone homeless. I'm talking about shelter, I'm talking about emergency room visits, I'm talking about jail nights, and that sort of thing. When you compare that $40,000 to the $13,000 or so a year that it takes to provide a housing subsidy and access to case management, the cost argument becomes a no-brainer.
My guest today is Jeffrey Olivet. He is the CEO for the Center for Social Innovation. He is one of the keynote plenary speakers at the upcoming Zero Mental Health Symposium. He'll be speaking on homelessness in America, where we've been and where we're going. And of course, you talked a bit about housing first, and this is a big initiative. It's something we're using in our community. The communities that are using this approach have seen dramatic reductions in the number of homeless. And I know your group works a lot on establishing best practices. Is this one of the best practices for ending long-term homelessness?
Absolutely. I mean, Housing First has been one of the most exciting trends I've seen in 20 years of work in this field. It recognizes housing as a basic human need and a basic human right, and it's shown to be effective. The research behind it is deep and sound and shows positive outcomes. I think most of the programs nationwide and indeed internationally that are implementing Housing First are showing somewhere in the neighborhood of 85 to 90% housing stability even after 3 years of transition from homelessness. So these programs are remarkably effective. I would say that a model like Housing First is also supplemented well by other best practices, including what happens around supportive services. I think the services piece sometimes gets lost because we do talk a lot about housing, and housing is, of course, essential to solving homelessness, but housing alone is not always sufficient. For some people it may be, but for others the need for ongoing support, ongoing access to health care, to mental health care, to substance abuse treatment, to job training are all essential elements as well. And then I would say the third leg of that stool, if you think about housing and supportive services, the third leg of that stool is social connection. And I think about this in terms of my own family and friends and social network and all of the ways I might be connected in my own community. Those threads that weave us into the fabric of the towns in which we live, of the faith communities of which we're a part, are absolutely essential. So the solution to homelessness, to me, is housing, absolutely, but housing and services to give people the support they need. And yet that's not enough. It's housing and services and reconnection to people, to community, to meaning.
Let's talk a little bit about that idea of reconnecting. How does that work in a housing first situation?
Well, let me start off by saying, Rich, that I think this is sort of new territory for a lot of the service providers and advocates. I think the emphasis over the last 15 or 20 years really has been on housing and formal services. And the question of helping someone rebuild social networks and social capital so that they really can lift themselves out of their poverty, so that we as a society can support people in not just stability but upward mobility as well, I think it's new territory. I think there are some very effective programs around the country that focus on job skills and support, that focus on reconnecting people with family, that focus on people's spiritual lives and their faith journeys to the extent that that's a vital piece of many people's recovery. And I think there are some other really exciting trends in the areas of art and kind of social connection and making art together and becoming part of a community that's making music, that's making visual arts. There are other models that are really focusing on food, on cooking, on social enterprise, where people who have been homeless are coming together to start a cafe or a restaurant that becomes a commercially viable part of the community, not simply a rehab program. So I think there are some exciting trends, but I think we're at the front edge of that set of innovations.
You know, it's interesting you talk about reconnecting a new set of social connections, because even the homeless have social connections, you know, between their own population. And I'm wondering, can that be a detriment to moving into housing and to moving forward with either formal treatment or informal treatment and building a new set of social connections?
It's a really good question and a tricky one. I don't think we should assume that all the relationships someone has while they're experiencing homelessness are by definition negative or destructive.
Right, right.
But we also must recognize that some are. That
yeah.
some people are pulled down by some of those relationships, whether it has to do with ongoing drug activity or simply just human connection, that the people you know happen to be the ones who are living out in the woods together or under the bridge or at the shelter. So I think we collectively should sort of recognize that when people do exit homelessness, they're often leaving behind friends and connections and some social capital, even if it's not necessarily the most supportive or most healthy. One interesting distinction around this, there are some researchers at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government who focus on different types of social capital. And this is Bob Putnam and Tom Sander and others who talk about bonding capital, which has to do with connecting with people who are in a very similar situation to your own, and bridging capital, which has to do with building connections that can help you move beyond the situation that you're currently in. And I think what you just identified, Rich, is that many people who are homeless might have some real bonding capital, connection with other people who are in a similar situation, but very little bridging capital that helps them move beyond that situation. I think the challenge is, how do we help people increase their access to bridging capital, to those relationships that can really help provide the stable platform from which people can and do recover from homelessness and trauma and mental illness and addiction.
My guest today is Jeffrey Olivetti. He is the CEO for the Center for Social Innovation, located just outside of Cambridge. He will be one of the keynote speakers at the Zero Mental Health Symposium, speaking on homelessness in America, where we've been and where we're going. Well, we've talked about two of those three legs that you talked about, you know, and the third is the supportive services. Now, one of the key components of Housing First is the idea that in many situations, the supportive services is something that you get the homeless into housing, and then it's there, it's encouraged, but it's not demanded as a condition of housing. How important is that idea of the housing not being conditioned on getting services?
I think it's essential to the housing first mentality. Housing is seen to be a human right, a basic necessity for living life on the planet as a human being. If you start there, what you do is then you basically say, well, what each of us might do or not do in our housing is our own business. Now, you know, the question becomes, well, if as a society we're subsidizing someone's housing, can we and should we demand treatment, demand that they address their underlying issues?
And when you look at political rhetoric, that tends to be that tends to be the focus, doesn't it?
It does. It does. You know, how can we sort of make these folks fix what's wrong with them? And I think if you start from a strengths-based point of view that says, when given the proper access to supports, people do make healthy choices all the time. People do choose to address physical health issues. They choose to become sober from drugs and alcohol. They choose to access mental health treatment or case management. That people inherently want to be in a healthier space than they are now. I think if we start with that mindset, what a housing first model would say is you get people into housing because that's the stable base from which they can then begin rebuilding their lives. And you offer a wide range of services and supports, from mental health to physical health care to drug and alcohol treatment to trauma counseling to job training to education, but you don't require it. Because if you require that and someone's not quite ready to stop drinking, for example, then they're going to end up right back on the street, and that does nobody any good. What does good is to provide stable housing so that the person can begin to make healthy decisions.
And has that been the experience for the most part? When a person has the roof over their head, has that sort of, at the most basic level, support, will they seek additional support for the issues they might have that have contributed to their previous condition?
Yes, the research shows that most people do.
Let's talk a little bit about the Center for Social Innovation in our last few minutes. I know you guys are involved in a lot of different projects, everything from looking at some of the, you know, the aggravating conditions where you have homeless that have maybe mental disorders, trauma, and substance abuse. You're working on figuring out the best practices for, you know, when it's a combination of conditions that are at the heart. You're working on establishing mental health courts, which I found really interesting. Why is it important to have a judicial system where everybody knows, I guess, the system, if you will, for on mental health issues?
Yeah, to focus on the mental health courts project for just a minute, we're collaborating with a group called the Justice Center at the Council of State Governments, with support from the Department of Justice nationally. And the idea is that our criminal justice system, our jails, our courts, our probation and parole, have become a de facto landing place for many, many people with mental illness.
It's become our new institutions, really, unfortunately, in many sad cases.
No question about it. And those systems aren't particularly equipped to provide mental health services. That's not their reason to be in the world. And so what the mental health courts model does is basically try to connect people who have become criminally involved and who have mental illnesses to the supports and services they need in the community to prevent them from going back to jail, to help them connect with psychiatry, to, if it's appropriate, to get on medications. And that's been a really exciting trend. And we see it as well with drug courts, with family courts, and with homeless courts as an interesting model that started at St. Vincent de Paul Village in San Diego and has really taken off across the country. So these specialty courts can often serve as a jail diversion program. They can often serve as a bridge to help people get connected with the supports and services that they need.
How easy is it to get a court system to adopt a specific docket like that? I know even in Oklahoma, you know, drug courts are just now finally appearing in most counties. The few that don't are openly hoping to have those. You know, an additional mental health docket, you know, homeless docket. Is that something that the justice system is open to?
I'm amazed at how quickly and well these models are adopted. I think there's a sort of immediate aha moment that a lot of people in the criminal justice system have when they see these programs at work, either in their own community or in other communities that they visit. They simply work, and they simply work better been a revolving door that keeps people with mental illness or with drug and alcohol issues or with long-term histories of homelessness from cycling in and out of jail, in and out of the courts. It's just a better way of doing business, and I think that becomes very clear very quickly.
All right. What new programs are you involved in that you're most excited about at the center?
One of the projects that I'm most excited about is a project called Outside In, where we're collaborating with an artist, a French artist who's based in New York named J.R., who won the TED Prize in 2010, I believe. And we're working with communities around the country to plaster large-scale photographic images of people who are homeless and people who are not homeless, people who have mental illness, people who don't have mental illness. And we're taking these images and beginning to plaster them all over spaces around the country to raise awareness about the issue. So that's a pretty exciting one. Another project that that I'm really excited about is that we're moving into simulation games to train healthcare and human services providers to do their jobs better. So we're trying to take the best technologies that are available and help equip the workforce to be more effective in the work that it does.
And that's one of the things your group does, is it really tries to come up with best practices. And it sounds like you're offering training to reinforce those best practices.
That's right. I think we see a need for taking the things that have been shown to work and moving them into wider use. The question of scaling up what's working and really focusing on what the evidence tells us that works, so that communities aren't trying to recreate the wheel all over the country.
Let me ask you, our community seems to be taking the lead on Housing First. What is the situation around the country? Most communities going to this model? Most communities still reluctant to embrace it? Where does that stand?
Well, first of all, Tulsa's cool. You guys have it going on. I think it is certainly a national trend. I think we see more and more communities embracing a Housing First approach to providing long-term housing and supportive services to people. And again, it's a model that works, and once you start doing it, it becomes infectious. And so we've seen it in various pockets around the country really take off. I think there are still some places that aren't quite there yet, but all in all, the transformation of our thinking over the last decade has been amazing to me. We're no longer talking about managing homelessness in the shelters. We're talking about ending homelessness.
Yeah, and that's an amazing thing. That is great. Well, we look forward to your visit to Tulsa. Jeffrey Olivet, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rich.
Jeffrey Olivet is the CEO of the Center for Social Innovation in Needham, Massachusetts, and one of the keynote speakers at the Zero Mental Health Symposium titled From Housing to Recovery, Looking at Homelessness Issues This Year. The Zero Mental Health Symposium continues today and tomorrow. Tonight, the awards dinner features actress Glenn Close's sister Jenna, an anti-stigma advocate and mental health consumer. For details on the symposium, visit FromHousingToRecovery.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.